Hello, reader. You're plugged in to another episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. We hope you enjoy it.
Hi, I'm Sean Duval from News 24, and today, on the hottest day at Cape Town in living memory, I'm speaking to Michiel Haines about his novel, The Wildest Beauty, which is our book of the month for this month. And I think, Michiel, by now, what, your ninth novel?
11th.
11th. Hmm? Okay, there's two I must have missed there. Wow. I think just to introduce it, it's a marvelous novel. It's a novel that follows the story of two twin brothers as they go off to the First World War, which sounds like a fairly brutal summary, but there's a lot in it. The journey to the war is quite complicated, for one thing, Let's start at the beginning, and let me ask you about the twins, the idea of twins. You have in the, I think it's in the first or second chapter, one of the brothers, Danny, the brothers are Charlie and Danny, is reading an essay that his brother's going to hand in at school, and he's basically plagiarized Lemprière's Dictionary of Mythology, and it's the story of Castor and Pollux, who in Greek mythology are the twin children of Leda, who is in fact raped by a swan, or Zeus in the form of a swan, just yes. So you've got the background. And that kind of alerts us to the fact that the issue of twins is going to be important.
Yes.
And how their relationship plays out.
Yeah.
So tell us a bit about how you got to the idea of twins, what that gave you in terms of sort of narrative material.
I really stumbled across it because I went to Derval Wood and the museum there, and of course there's a beautiful memorial by Herbert Baker, and as a centerpiece to this there is a statue of two clearly warriors with a horse. You know, it's one of those typical sort of martial pieces of art. And then I read about it, and apparently this is Castor and Pollux. I don't know what identifies it as Castor and Pollux, but so I read up about Castor and Pollux, and then I thought, well, why should my brothers not be twins? And then the rest followed. I mean, I think the whole idea of the whole idea of twinship, as it were, is one of also a kind of internecine battle between them, because, you know, they, and I played around a lot with the idea of twins loving each other and hating each other, you know, that kind of stuff. So as I say, I really stumbled across it, but then it became central to the tale. I mean, that there is a tension between the brothers all the time, and it has to do with, well, it started in the womb, as it were, when they were battling for space. So, yes, that's how I came across the idea of twins, and it became central, as I said, it was just a thought.
And it's important to the story, obviously, that one of the twins, the older by, say, 10 minutes, Charles or Charlie is a sort of golden boy of his generation. He's like the hero of the whole school. He's the star rugby player. He's the Victor Ludorum. He wins all the prizes, and that leaves the 10 minutes younger brother Danny with a certain amount of resentment, even though he adores his brother, but is desperate for his attention and so forth. But there's an underlying sort of sense, I suppose you call it resentment. That in many ways generates a number of the issues that come up in the plot, because they're twin brothers, they're indissolubly linked in some way, but at the same time there are these areas of conflict.
Yes.
So I'm interested that I was going to ask you, well, you've got twins, you've got the First World War, you're sort of two, I think, major sort of narrative complexes in the book. And I was going to ask how you got to the twins, from the twins to the First World War, but it sounds like you started with the First World War.
I did, and went to, as I said, Elwood and discovered the twins there.
Right. So were you thinking, I want to write a book about the First World War?
Well, that goes back a long time because I've always had a sort of interest in the First World War, and I can date this back to my first year at university when we did a poem by Wilfred Owen, you know, Futility. And I was fascinated by this because I didn't understand the poem. And then I had to do a bit of research, not very deep research, but to see, you know, what is happening here. It is an officer speaking about clearly one of his men who died during the night. And I found this idea very appealing. And when I got to third year, we had to write a long essay. So I wrote my long essay on Wilfred Owen. And I still am totally addicted to Wilfred. I still think that his commentary on the war, it's not really a commentary, but his depiction of the war, is some of the most profound that there is, because he felt so deeply about his men. So it's not an abstract writing about the war. He describes certain situations in the war that bring home to us very strongly what it was actually like. You know? Anyway, so I'm rambling, but Wilfred Owen has been my go-to all the time. I mean, I did a lot of other reading too, but you know, you go and you read his poetry, and you know, every poem has a kind of insight into a different aspect of the war. So that's really how I became interested in the war. Okay. You know,
He is a marvelous poet. I mean, I can't remember when I first read him, but you know, the lines, what passing bells for those who die as cattle.
Yes. Only the stuttering rifle's rapid rattle.
Exactly. You skipped a line there, but but I mean, it's very powerful.
It is,
And I think that reading that and some of the other First World War poets, Isaac Rosenberg. I don't know if you know his poetry. No. I wondered whether you're naming a character Isaac.
It was
a little reference to Isaac Rosenberg.
No, it wasn't conscious, but I'm pleased if it does. establish a, yeah. Because Rosenberg is wonderful too. In a somewhat different vein to, of course, you know, to Wilfred Owen.
And there was an interesting little book from Penguin a while ago when they were doing those little mini books.
Yes.
That was, I think, a selection from a book collecting First World War poetry. And it was interesting to read all those poets kind of together in a way.
Yeah.
And I emerged from it kind of thinking it was Owen and Rosenberg.
Yes.
Were the great. Siegfried Sassoon kind of went down a little in one's estimation. I mean, maybe one would go back to the prose or memoirs of an infantry officer.
I think it's quite an irony that Siegfried Sassoon has really encouraged Owen to write, and Owen worshipped Sassoon. Mm. And that really, Owen is the greater poet, you know.
So in the, I mean, you talk about your references and how you sort of read around this in the First World War. I think you say in your acknowledgements that a lot of what you read to get a feeling of the war was personal material, was people's diaries, reminiscences, direct descriptions of it. So that obviously gave you quite an in on how it felt.
Yes, I wouldn't say it was a deliberate choice, but the way it worked out was that I was reading all these letters, memoirs, and so on. And then you just become conscious of the war not as a sort of battleground, but as a very intimate thing. As even one of the commentators that I quote said that trench life was very intimate. I mean, that, you know, there were millions of people there, but you knew only about 10 people. And he says it was a bit like a family, where you just have to put up with them because they're your family. And that aspect of the war became very real to me. It's not, you know, the great battles, although, you know, we end up with a great battle, but the daily friction of a group of men who had nothing in common except being drafted to this war or volunteered for the war. So yes, I mean, that the war is a backdrop, and it's a very important backdrop. And of course, by the end of the novel, it moves to the foreground. Mm-hmm. But really, I was interested in the family aspect of war. In fact, I think the novel deals with various kinds of families, and this is a very important one.
I think that relates to the one line that I picked out that I really liked and that I thought summed a lot of things up. Was exactly what you're talking about, the guys at war. As in a family, there could be affinities but no choices.
Yeah.
They were kind of thrown together, and out of that, and I think it's very beautifully done in the book how you show the different characters of the different men who've been thrown together.
Yeah.
Obviously, it helps develop the plot because there are rivalries. There's information that some have that others don't have. And the individual relationships between pairs here and there, I think it's Matthias and Farnie is an interesting connection. So it does become a kind of a family, an unchosen family. They're stuck together in this horrible situation. That relates in turn to the family issues that exist within Charlie and Danny's family.
Yes.
That there's a slightly more complicated family history perhaps there than they initially knew about, and they discover this in the course of their meanderings towards the war, really, they don't just get on a ship and go straight to the war. They end up, there's a whole long, perhaps you can tell us a bit about that and their circuitous route.
Yes, that was a matter of necessity rather than choice, because, you know, I was faced with a problem. How did they go about it, and how did they get there? So I decided to follow one particular regiment, South African regiment, and based it largely on a very extensive diary that one of the men kept of where they were when. And this was a bit inconvenient on occasion because I wanted them to get to the front and start fighting, instead of which they first, of course, went to Potchefstroom all the way from Cape Town. Then they came back and they went to England and they spent a lot of time there. And of course, then one of them went to Edinburgh and then when they thought they were going to France, they were sent to Egypt because someone had decided that, you know, they were needed there. And then only did they go to France. And even then, by a detour, I mean, they didn't go straight to the front. So I just followed that, and I'm afraid just had to fill in, as it were, things that happened on the way there. Because, spoiler alert, but the actual battle takes a very... very little of the novel. Most of it is getting there. And I didn't really mind that in the end, because I think my attention shifted from, this is going to be the battle of the century, to this is a group of young men confronting each other as much as confronting the Germans. So as I say, that circuitous route was not my choice, but I decided to follow it. I don't know, because I'm sure that I'm probably wildly inaccurate in many things, but I wanted to be sure that I sort of made sense in terms of how they got there. So there is a detour to Egypt and so on, and quite a few of those details there of the horrible things that happened to them on board ship that I got from diaries.
And interestingly, I think you mentioned this in one of your launch interviews, that the writing of the book itself in a way has a circuitous quality, because you'd written a fair amount of it and then you stopped. I think you said you got them, the soldiers, you got them to Salt River.
Salt River Station.
And then you kind of had to leave them there for a time.
Yes.
You wrote another book.
Yes.
And then you came back and they finished their journey.
Yes.
Which is an interesting thing in terms of writer's process. But it made me think that it's interesting that in this book there's a not quite random, but a sort of chance meeting between Danny and an officer in Victoria Station. They go through the streets of London, and they have a very important encounter. It's very important for Danny. And in the book that you presumably wrote while your soldiers were stuck in Salt River, there's also a London encounter in Every Mortal Thing.
Oh, yes.
There's also sort of an important encounter that's a chance encounter.
Yes.
That becomes important for the characters.
Yeah.
And I wonder, this kind of book where you've got quite a wide canvas, you've got quite a long way to go, the role of that sort of chance encounter, the things that could just happen out of the blue to people.
Yes.
How that kind of works for you in terms of writing fiction. I mean, does it become a thing that in a way you sort of have a chance encounter with the character and then find a way to bring the story out of that?
Yes, I'm pleased you ask that, because it's something I became conscious of in writing this, is how often I do that in my novels without realizing that I'm doing it. My way, I think, of advancing a plot is make my character meet someone. You know, it happens clearly in Each Mortal Thing. It happens in the one in Italy. He's standing on he's on his way to Italy. He's standing on the airport. He turns around. There's a man behind him. Mm. I didn't know who this man was. I mean, it's this, buffer boy. Mm. This becomes a major character. So in a way, I'm depending on chance encounters, and then I see what happens, because often these characters assume a life of their own. A case in point, of course, is Mirkat, who he also meets him when he's standing in a queue. I think I often place my characters in a queue and then see what happens to them. And that really is, I think, without my planning it, is the central part of how I conceive of characters, chance meeting. I quote from Wilfred Owen's poem, Strange Meeting, where there are so many meetings in my novels, and they all often fateful. And this isn't based on some kind of philosophical truth that I cherish. It just so happens that is the way my plot sort of almost assumes a life of its own. Make him meet someone. Let's see what happens. I didn't know what Mirkat was going to turn out like, and he just started talking, and he foul-mouthed and promiscuous and everything else, and he takes over the novel, really. So
he is a very interesting character.
He is, yes. I think he's my favorite character in the novel.
And an interesting contrast as well to another key character in the novel we haven't spoken about, someone called Andrew Sinclair.
Yes.
Who, most of the novel is narrated by Danny in his own voice, but there are sort of interjections or interpolations, as it were, from the diary of Andrew Sinclair, who has become the older brother Charlie's sort of best friend, or I suppose he wants to be a kind of mentor to Charlie, or a sort of, he's a religious nut, so he's kind of his spiritual mentor in a way, or wants to be. He's an interesting character because he's so conflicted, plays an important part in what happens in the novel, and partly the degree to which there's some kind of alienation between Charlie and Danny is to do with Andrew Sinclair.
Yes.
And in many ways, he's a very unpleasant character.
Very much so.
But obviously a key part of the book. So how did it work for you, kind of flipping between these two narrative voices in a way, or these two narrative streams?
Yes, I wasn't quite sure about this, and I'm still not sure that it was such a good idea to have as an extraneous narrator, because, as you say, the novel is narrated by Danny, but then you have extracts from Andrew Sinclair's diary. And that obviously is just a way of getting into Andrew Sinclair's mind, because we don't have any other access. And I wanted him as a as a variant on themes that elsewhere are perhaps treated more sympathetically. The novel doesn't like Andrew Sinclair. I don't like Andrew Sinclair.
But anybody likes him, except Charlie, for a bit.
And so some of my friends said, well, why have him? And I think the answer to that would be that, you know, to put it baldly, the novel deals with so many different kinds of love, you know, that... And this is one variant, and it's a twisted kind of love, but it also is a very strong one. I mean, he dies for his love. I mean, spoiler alert. So Andrew Sinclair, I'm slightly uneasy about, because I think we're perhaps too consciously there to introduce a certain perspective that I couldn't find in any other way.
Mm.
You know, he's very religious. He's very mixed up sexually, and he becomes a kind of, Danny hates him, you know, and so he also, in a way, advances that relationship, the depiction of that relationship. So he was useful.
Mm.
I didn't like him, and I don't expect the reader to like him, but he has a certain... gift of the gab. I mean, he's very he's quite acerbic.
But he's obviously quite persuasive as well.
Yes,
his relationship with Charlie. If Charlie's going to listen to him, sit at his feet, as it were, for all that time.
I think it's also useful in giving us some light on Charlie, because Charlie is a leading character and so on. But he is actually bamboozled by Andrew Sinclair. I mean, he swallows the Sinclair's principles, and that I think also shows up the limitations of Charlie's grasp of things. Of course, Danny is just jealous, but in his jealousy, I think he reaches some sound judgments on Andrew Sinclair.
Mm. So you've written, do we say 11 novels?
This is the 11th. Yes,
this is the 11th novel. A number of them have been historical novels.
Yes.
Two or three of them. I suppose you could count The Children's Day as a historical novel in a way.
In a way,
I mean, it's set in a particular period.
It is
important to it.
Yeah.
But the one to me that sticks out that in a way I think, it's almost kind of like disappeared from your works. You know, if you look you up online, it doesn't pop up. I Am Pandarus, which is a historical novel of a peculiar kind.
Yeah, I'm pleased you mentioned that, because I also feel a bit aggrieved on behalf of that novel. It's set in a classical time. Also, I had to do a lot of reading. I like the novel, but it certainly did disappear. I mean, I think
I'm the only person who read it, actually.
Yeah, well, I have a friend who read it recently and said, I didn't know about this novel.
Mm.
So perhaps I have had two readers on that one. But it's, I found it, the history fascinating, as with the First World War. I mean, you do the research and then you create the characters to enact what you assume to have been the case. And I did like that novel, and I was sorry that it was sort of widely ignored.
Mm.
But, you know, I remember my publisher at the time saying to me, please, I want you to write a South African novel now.
Mm.
I said, well, you know, I hate to break the news to you, but my next novel is set in... you know, in classical times, nothing to do with South Africa. But, in fact, my historical novels tend to be non-South African, and I think to the dismay of my publisher, because I think local novels sell better than novels about a different time, a different continent, and so on. So I did include Stellenbosch in this one.
I think even in your novels that are largely set in South Africa... your characters seem to do a fair amount of traveling.
Yes.
They get out of South Africa. They go somewhere else. They come back. Or they don't come back.
Yes. Yes.
I think that's an accurate observation.
Yes, it is. It's I'm a bit perturbed to hear it put so boldly. But yes, I suppose that, you know, growing up to me was also a matter of, you know, traveling, finding other countries. And, well, one novel was about the suffragettes, you know, and another one was about Henry James. That's hardly South African. But that has had more to do with my reading, you know, because I think a lot of what I'm writing, well, obviously, is influenced by what I was reading. And that is often not South African.
Right.
So, So this really is not based on, as far as I know, any particular novel or anything like that. There are, I suppose, echoes of things that I've read, but not nothing as specific as in those novels I've mentioned.
And you mentioned a few other novels and other works in the course of this, because you seem to have exceptionally literate characters. They've actually read a few books. I mean, Meerkat, who, I mean, you know, okay, he's a bishop's boy, for whatever that means. But I mean, he's reading Nietzsche, for heaven's sake, on the way to war.
Yes.
You would have thought that was a mistake. Perhaps something lighter.
Well, yes.
I mean, on his part, a mistake, not yours. On his part, a mistake, not yours.
Yes, because he clearly takes to heart Nietzsche's sort of dark mutterings. Yes, I like my characters to be able to quote things that I want quoted. And fortunately, all my boys are pretty well-educated, so they sort of fling quotations at each other. I hope it's not as mechanical as that. Yes, I suppose it comes with having lectured for all my life, you know, that I tend to see things in terms of other books, and then I'm tempted to bring those books into my books, perhaps to the exasperation of some of my readers who say, well, why should we know this, you know? I go where, you know, my subconscious leads me, as it were.
And speaking of that, and speaking of Henry James, I mean, just take a step back from this particular book. Who are the writers? What are the books that apart from sort of a quote here and there, that you think have a bearing on your work as a whole? Who are the writers that sort of enticed you into writing yourself?
I think that would have to be Henry James. Because I think I was attracted, I was attracted to his approach, which is intensely personal, I want to say psychological. His plots are driven by what doesn't really show on the surface, you know, the kind of conflicts that are often unspoken and often very vicious, because this is, you know, England under, you know, just after the Victorian age. So there's a lot of this unspoken there. And I think that's what drew me to that there's so much that you can unravel. As one of my favorite novels is The Golden Bowl, which is often regarded as totally unreadable. Because
it's late in his career, is it not?
It's what?
It's late in his career.
It's very late. It's his last novel. And or is it? Anyway, it's one of the last great three novels. Yes, it's because he is interested in things that are unspoken, you know, and these things happen under the surface. And the poor reader has to sit there and think, what on earth is happening here? But I think James knows exactly what is happening. And, you know, I wrote my PhD on Henry James, and I really am in love with how he conveys currents of feeling in a very subtle way. There's no huge sort of showdowns. But in fact, you know, something like The Golden Bowl, you know, a person wrote an essay on it called The Novel, Henry James' Novel About Nothing. But in fact, you know, there are incredible things happening under the surface. I mean, it's a battlefield, you know, of these people are really sort of savaging each other in a very civilized way.
It's happening on a very intimate level.
Very intimate level. And not really spoken. It's not quite unspoken, but there's a sort of, there's always a sort of maneuvering of situations and positions. And I find that very appealing. I love Dickens. I love Joseph Conrad in particular. But what I would go to would always be Henry James.
And the literature that you've taught, does that have any bearing? I suppose if you teach literature, you've got a lot of different things, right?
Yes. You know, and some of it, of course, is what you have to teach, and some of it is what you want to teach. And in my teaching, when I had a choice, I tended to concentrate on the novel, often the 19th century novel, but also the modernist novel, Henry James and those people. That's just the period I find most congenial. But, you know, I love Shakespeare. Yes, of course, one does. But I wouldn't call myself a Shakespearean. So, yes, I if I had a choice, I would always try to teach the novel, especially, you know, at a graduate level where you can do the Golden Bowl and not have your class go to sleep, although they tend to go to sleep anyway. But, you know, that is a... So.
Okay, that's very interesting. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah.
Discussion of your book and your reading and your sources.
Yes, I suppose I'm one of those writers who are reading writers, as it were, and therefore perhaps overdo the literary references.
I think readers, you know, writers always got their sources somewhere in the background. Yeah. It's just that very often they're concealed.
Yeah. I suppose some writers would say, we write about life, not about literature. Yes. No. But it's just life at one remove.
Michiel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Sean.
Love you talking to you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Did you love what you heard? Don't just stop at the stories. Buy the books. Visit your favorite bookstore to grab your next read. And remember to subscribe, share, and join us again next week for more fascinating conversations. Until then, happy reading.